Now a look at the challenges of launching a new company. The founders of Blue Box Now, a web-based marketing firm, felt they were on track at the beginning. The Seattle startup had lined up a large paying customer, it had lots of other great leads, and it was reasonably confident it would have a sizable amount of outside funding. But a lot has happened since those first days. Morning Edition has been following the startup, and NPR's Wendy Kaufman brings us this update.
The past couple of months have been pretty gut-wrenching for the team at Blue Box Now. One of the original founders had to leave Seattle because of a family medical emergency, and he took a full-time job somewhere else. Then, says Chad Reed, one of the remaining co-founders, there was a legal challenge.
That was a doozy. I'll tell you what. We received this letter in the mail and then also over email. There's another group in Seattle called the Blue Box Group.
That group wanted the startup to quit using the Blue Box name. Reed says while they thought they would prevail on the legal issue, they couldn't afford to fight.
Instead of us paying $40,000 to fight this, we're going to end up changing our name. The Blue Box itself, the gift that we give, is still a key component to what we do. It's just changing up the name, and we're going to be okay with it.
The startup's goal is to help its clients increase customer loyalty and spending through the use of online games and prizes. But so far, just one company has signed up. That marketing campaign is months behind schedule, so there's no money coming in. Moreover, without proof their marketing concept works, it's difficult for the team to attract investors. Getting investors, be they angels or venture capitalists, was the main goal for Demo Day, held last month in Seattle.
My name is Chad Reed. This is my co-founder, Naresh Damon. Today, we're going to show you how we're changing the way loyalty marketing is done. Our platform is available on web, smartphones, and on tablets.
Blue Box, or whatever it's going to be called, was a participant in a highly selective incubator and boot camp for technology startups. Their presentation at Techstars Demo Day was attended by hundreds of people. Many of them were investors. And afterward, CEO Naresh Damon was sounding pretty optimistic.
Actually, one of the investors was saying, okay, do you have term sheet? So that is very motivating. But I think what benefits most is the right investor also.
But right now, Blue Box would likely be happy with almost any investor.
I'm Brad Gillespie from IA Ventures, a early stage venture firm based in New York City. As an investor, I'm really focused on five things. In order of priority, it's people, 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 market, and product.
Gillespie had been talking to the Blue Box team and was impressed, but in the end didn't invest. And another potential investor, Dave Carlson, is still on the sidelines. Carlson said he likes what Blue Box is doing, but he wants to see more numbers.
I'm a very financially oriented investor. I say my head and my heart have to be aligned, and the numbers have to make sense.
Faced with the reality that they don't have nearly as much money as they'd expected to raise by now, the founders of Blue Box are rethinking their options. Chad Reed says lots of well-known companies remain interested in talking to them, and he believes that if a sizable number sign up for their marketing campaigns, the startup will be able to raise a chunk of money. But in the meantime, Reed, who's been working without a salary since spring, doesn't get paid.
If we don't get funding, I mean, I can't live, right? I mean, you have to make money. I believe so much in this company that, yes, I'm going to continue building it and moving forward, but I'm going to have to take some sort of consulting job, which means that you're not spending the time that you should be on the product.
Which means, of course, it could take longer to get those customers. As for Naresh Damon, his wife is talking about getting a job, allowing him to continue to focus on Blue Box. And he, like Chad Reed, remains optimistic. After all, no one ever said that launching a startup would be easy. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
We want to switch gears now to focus on technology. $1.25 billion. That's the estimated total in online spending on Cyber Monday, a record. And you've probably noticed yourself how much technology affects nearly every facet of your daily life, whether it's checking email on your iPhone, keeping track of your finances on a laptop, or streaming your Netflix through a video game console at home. But just who's capitalizing as technology and the internet revolution continue to boom? Silicon Valley, the nation's hub for technology, is largely seen seen as an industry dominated by white males. And according to the firm CB Insights, only about 1% of internet startups headed by African Americans received funding from venture capitalists in the first half of 2010. That's compared to a whopping 87% of internet startups started by whites. So today we decided to invite two people to talk about the challenge of working in the technology field. Joining us to talk about this are Latoya Drake. She's a digital correspondent for AOL. She's also an adjunct professor of marketing, advertising, and public relations at NYU. Also with us, Angela Benton. She's the founder and CEO of Black Web Media. Her company produces Black Web 2.0, which aims to attract and connect African-American innovators and consumers on the web. She was also featured in CNN's most recent documentary from Soledad O'Brien. It was called Black in America, the New Promised Land, Silicon Valley. Ladies, welcome to you both. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having
me. Glad to be here.
I'm very interested. You know, the CNN documentary got a lot of attention in part because it explored this whole question of why it is that African-Americans have not been as present on the business side of the internet boom. One of the things that unfolded is that African-Americans have difficulty getting past the firewall. So why is that? You know, what is your take on this based on your firsthand experience here?
Sure. Well, it's a couple of different things for African-Americans and really for minorities, you know, in general. And one big thing is mentorship. So when you look around, I mean, honestly, even if you look at your family, you know, my sister understands what I do, but my brother, you know, not so much. So when you look at mentorship and role models, you know, those aren't really that prevalent. So that's kind of the first thing. The second thing is when people choose an industry, if you choose to be in media or publishing or fashion, then, you know, New York's an obvious choice. And if you choose to be an actor, LA is an obvious choice. And Silicon Valley really is that hub for technology. And so to be here and to network, because a lot of the business that's being done here, it's who you know and who you get referred to. So you really have to be infused into the network to benefit from it.
Latoya, what's your take on it?
You know what? I have to piggyback off what Angela is saying in terms of networking and who you know. And from my perspective and simply what I observe every day, it's the types of people who get hired and are brought into a company. In many cases, it's because they know someone on the inside. And that's not to say that they were unfairly selected, but when you have, I work, for instance, with stars, very high quality talent. So they know other high quality talent. So if you don't know the right people, I think more than anything, it will need to go beyond simply blindly applying for that job on a job site. And I think that's one of the things that hinders people who are interested in breaking into this business, simply not knowing the right people.
We're talking about women and minorities in technology in the wake of a record Cyber Monday, which reminded all of us of how the role that technology plays in our lives in this point in our history right now. We're talking with Angela Benton, the CEO and founder of Black Web Media, and Latoya Drake, a digital correspondent for AOL. All right, Angela, here's the tough question. Is there a skills gap?
Well, if you look at all the data, you know, there is obviously a pipeline issue. There aren't many minorities graduating with STEM degrees. However,
STEM being
science, technology, math, engineering degrees. But everyone wants to put a lot of focus on that. Like, sure, I agree with that. There aren't many minorities with STEM degrees. But if you look at the technology industry, there are so many people with finance degrees, business degrees, and they've taught themselves, you know, how to code. So the barrier to entry is quite low. And so, yes, there's a pipeline issue, but, you know, no, that's not the only issue.
Latoya, what's your take on it?
I certainly don't think that a particular degree is necessary. And I think this just because in reading something like the Steve Jobs book and you see his background and what was so key for him is being at that intersection of the humanities and technology, there has to be a passion. I think if this is something that you do naturally and you don't think twice about the use of technology in your life, for instance, if you have an iPad and you're naturally curious about the apps that pop up or the ads that pop up when you're in a particular app and you're curious about what's the next step, how did that get there, or if you're in a store scanning a QR code because you want to know where is this taking me on my smartphone, it's that type of passion that can take you to the next step. And I think it is key to merchandise those types of passions. And I think if a person doesn't have a particular degree, merchandising those passions can get you to the next level.
I'm wondering, though, whether when you talked about the pipeline issue, I asked about the skills gap, if there was one indeed, but I'm wondering if there isn't a risk gap. For example, Angela, I'm thinking about a story that you told where you were speaking at Howard University, which is a preeminent historically black university, and a student approached you about wanting to pursue a career as an internet innovator, but said his family wasn't supportive because he said his family had sacrificed so much to get him to this point that they were afraid he would lose it all. They thought it was kind of a crapshoot.
Absolutely.
And so they really were kind of pushing him to do something safe, you know, that they understood. And
right.
I'm wondering if, you know, if that isn't part of the attitude, that the people who do have the skill set and the appetite and the desire, perhaps that there's this acculturation, you know, the feeling is that we just can't risk it.
No, absolutely. I mean, and, you know, while the work that I do focuses on African-Americans, women and Latinos, generally black culture is risk averse. So we tend to do the safer things, and especially as it relates to going to college and then getting a good job and then rising up the corporate ladder. Being an entrepreneur and being a technology entrepreneur is something that is really, really risky. The skills gap is one thing, and the risk gap is another thing.
Latoya, before we let you go, just a final thought from you. Why does it matter that Silicon Valley be more diverse than it is? I mean, people might be listening to this conversation and say, oh, that's too bad for them. It's too bad that there aren't more minorities and women involved in technology. But I love my iPad. I love my iPhone. I love my Android. Why does this matter?
It matters because we want to see what I'm passionate about reflected on these apps. I want to be able to engage with content and apps that I enjoy and that I understand. And who's developing those? Who speaks my language? Who understands my cultural background? So you want to see people developing for your interest set. Certainly, we carry many of them around in our purses every day, but there's a part of the business that can be tapped into from the minority perspective, and I think that is developing content that we are all interested in and that we want to engage with.
Latoya Drake is a digital correspondent for AOL. She's also an adjunct professor of marketing, advertising, and public relations at NYU. She joined us from our New York studios. Angela Benton is the founder and CEO of Black Web Media. Her company produces Black Web 2.0, which aims to attract and connect African-American innovators and consumers on the web. She was with us from member station KCSM in San Mateo, California. Thank you both so much.
Thanks for having
me. Pleasure to be here.
If you spend any time on Twitter, the online service will be sure to advise you what's trending. That's the Twitter equivalent of trendy, what people are telling each other about right now. Earlier this morning, the trends in the Washington, D.C. area included Jersey Shore and Pearl Harbor. It matters what trends, because those little listings become an advertisement encouraging more people to pay attention to that topic. Sometimes a topic that seems like it should be hot, like Occupy Wall Street, does not trend, which has led some activists to charge Twitter with censorship. But as NPR's Laura Seidel reports, it's not about censorship, but about algorithms.
Getting a spot on Twitter's trending topic list has become so important that television programs hire consultants to help them get there.
And it's such an honor to be singing this song with Christina Aguilera.
The voice really set the tone.
That's Jason Pollock, a social media consultant. The Voice became one of the most popular singing competitions on TV with the help of Twitter. Teams of young singers like Raquel Castro get coached by stars like Christina Aguilera for a competition.
This is an amazing opportunity. I'm only 16 years old, and it's kind of nerve-wracking because I haven't performed that a lot.
As competitors are training for the competition, says Pollock, they tweet with some help from paid staff. They put pound signs in front of important catchy phrases to create hashtags like Team Nakia.
They had them really operating fast, and they were pumping it out, and they had hashtags going, and they were asking questions and doing polls and really engaging stuff.
And when those hashtags hit the trending topics list on Twitter, more people started to watch The Voice on TV.
If you start trending on Twitter, people on Twitter will turn that show on. So, you know, where everyone is obsessed about the ratings, well, here's a new tool to up your ratings.
Or bring attention to your cause.
Let them go!
During the tense moments of Occupy Oakland, freelance journalist Susie Cagle was following the Occupy Wall Street hashtag.
Just looking at how often I was tweeting, let alone how often others were on the same Occupy Oakland hashtag, there have been times where that hashtag is scrolling and updating so quickly that there's no way I can keep up.
Yet it struck her as odd that Occupy Oakland wasn't on trending topics even after weeks of protests.
And to not see those things trending a month in was surprising.
On blogs, some Occupy Wall Street activists charged Twitter with censoring its trending topics list. Why were there trending hashtags like what you find in ladies' handbags or things thirsty people do? Twitter's Matt Graves says it's because the protests have been going on for weeks.
We look at trending topics as a reflection of what people are talking about more right now in this moment than they were a minute ago, an hour ago, or a day ago.
And when Graves says we, he's really talking about Twitter's secret algorithm that sorts through 250 million tweets a day. It's designed to search for the sudden appearance of a topic in large volume.
And that may mean, for example, when Steve Jobs dies, you know, that there are different trending topics around that. It may mean on a local level, when there's an earthquake, whether it's in Oklahoma or in California, being able to go and see, well, you know, is earthquake trending in Oklahoma right now?
There had been thousands of tweets for Occupy Wall Street regularly over many weeks. So Twitter's algorithms stopped putting it on the trending topics list. In some ways, Twitter's algorithms act a lot like human news editors who are more interested in the latest news than an ongoing story, says Tarleton Gillespie, a communications professor at Cornell University.
It's going to be hard for us to think about the involvement of the algorithm in a way that we could understand the involvement of an editor, right, that might step in and say, I don't want to run this story, or I think this one's more important than that one. What does it mean that an algorithm decided that something was more important than something else?
Gillespie points to the Amazon bestseller list. In that case, it seems like a simple, unbiased calculation.
Naively, you would say, well, the most-selling book is number one, and the second-most-selling book is number two.
But a couple of years ago, there was a dust-up because all the gay books disappeared from the list. It turns out that Amazon doesn't let any adult books in its bestsellers, and someone accidentally put the gay books in that category.
It's a curated list. It's a list that will never show us if something that they or their publishers had classified as adult would ever show up there.
Everything from restaurant reviews to your friends' baby pictures to your local news is getting served up to you by an algorithm. As much as programmers may think their algorithms will deliver objective results, those calculations may be just as biased as a real human being. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
And you can follow this program on Twitter. We're at Morning Edition and at NPR Inskeep.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. In the battle of antibiotics versus bacteria, the bugs are winning. Not only are they evolving resistance to our arsenal of drugs, but we're running out of new antibiotics to launch at them. And antibiotic-resistant bacteria aren't just a problem for hospitals and patients. Think about wounded soldiers on the battlefield infected with superbugs, or a bioterrorism attack using resistant or engineered pathogens. Would we be able to handle it? That's why DARPA, the research arm of the Defense Department, has called on scientists to develop new next-generation antibiotics. One promising technology is DNA-based drugs that not only target the superbugs, but they can evolve right along with them, preventing antibiotic resistance. Chad Merkin is director of the International Institute for Nanotechnology at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Merkin.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
These are little nanoparticle sort of size things?
Yeah, they're really interesting structures. In fact, they're structures made out of DNA or RNA that are made on a gold nanoparticle. In fact, a variety of different types of particles, but they're strands of DNA that are arranged on the surface of these spherical particles. And when you make them in this manner, they have properties that are very different from the normal type of DNA that we're all familiar with, duplex linear type of DNA. And one of those properties is they have the ability to enter cells, including bacterial cells, very, very efficiently.
And when they get in the cell, what do they do?
Well, the beauty is what we can do. We can design them so that they can go in and flip switches, genetic switches, that either turn off resistance so that a conventional antibiotic will work, or better yet, stop replication and ultimately cause bacterial cell death.
So that so is there then no need for a standard antibiotic?
Well, this would be a different route to the standard antibiotics, which are typically small molecules. Mm-hmm. This would be a genetic-based route. And the beauty of that is that, as you said in your opening, you can move with the bug. As the bug evolves, you can change the sequence and target different genetic components of the bug so that you can constantly battle its response to the new drug.
So as the bug changes, you tailor make the new stuff to mimic what the bug is doing.
That's the idea. I mean, this is very early in this whole process. This is actually part of a big platform that we call spherical nucleic acids that we've been developing at Northwestern now for about 15 years and are part of a company that we started called Arisense that can really go after any sort of genetic disease. And that's the beauty of it. You can tailor it on a disease-by-disease basis as long as you have good genetic information about the different types of switches that you have to turn on or off to affect treatment.
If you have genetic diseases that are not, you know, antibiotic related, maybe like cancer or something like that, could you not go in and stop the cancers from spreading that way?
That's exactly right. In fact, we have a very active program in that regard. The beauty of these constructs, they're part of a larger field called gene regulation, which actually has won the Nobel Prize for its promise, the idea that you could use this a concept of switching off genes or down-regulating genes so that you could adjust protein levels and take effectively a disease cell and make it healthy, or in the case of a cancer cell, selectively cause it to die. The problem with conventional approaches is that they often have to have materials to help carry the genetic material into the cells, and they're not very good at targeting. In addition, they cause all sorts of toxic side effects. So you run into the problem where the therapy causes as many problems as the disease originally did. In this case, these structures, this spherical form of nucleic acid, has this incredible property that it requires no co-carrier. You can treat diseases based upon that genetic information, and you can either locally deliver. For example, we have projects with a dermatologist named Amy Poller, where we have the first constructs that can be delivered through the skin to go after things like melanoma and psoriasis. Or another project involves a guy named Alex Stegg, where we're going after brain cancer, and we can systemically deliver these. They go everywhere, but they cause no toxic side effects. And so they accumulate in a lot of cells, including tumor cells in the brain, and you can selectively go after those cells based upon the genetic differences of those cells causing them to selectively die.
So even though they get into the cells, their little genetic pieces don't match up with the wrong cells.
That's exactly right. You've got almost a lock and key type of shutoff here.
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of people who are concerned about pumping a bunch of nanoparticles into their bodies. And I guess they would be concerned about this too.
Potentially. I mean, the interesting thing about this is so typically we will use a gold particle and we'll arrange the nucleic acid, the DNA or RNA on the surface of the particle. And that itself can be a therapeutic, and we have a lot of therapeutic leads based upon those types of materials. But we've also figured out ways of what's called cross-linking, attaching the DNA strands on the surface of the particle to each other, and we can dissolve the gold. And we literally can use effectively pure nucleic acid in that case. And those types of constructs work just as well.
All right. Now for the $64 question, which I know you knew would be coming, right? And you could probably ask it of yourself. When are we going to have a product that is going to be available to try?
Well, I think the more important question to ask is when are we going to go into trials? So we have incredible in vivo data in animals, small animals, that suggests that this works and works extremely well. And it can do things that, frankly, no other gene regulation construct has ever done before. And that is delivery through the skin very effectively, knockdown in animals. And also this idea of systemic delivery, and what's really difficult in this field is getting these big drugs, because they're big particles compared to the small molecule drugs that we've been talking about, getting them across the blood-brain barrier. And the beautiful thing about these constructs is they show the ability to do that. And so the real question is how soon will we be into trials? And we're really shooting for next year. So we're hopeful that we're going to be into human trials sometime next year. Pushing for the early part, but certainly before the end of the year.
Mm-hmm. And as far as antibiotics are concerned, do you consider them old hat now?
No, I wouldn't consider them old hat. I mean, this may end up being a co-therapy or maybe a replacement for existing antibiotics. But there's a lot of work has to be done. So the DARPA program is actually new. It was, I think, really insightful for them to take this on and to challenge the community to come up with new ways, because the world desperately needs these types of constructs. We have to really go through and validate these in the context of bacteria. like we have in the context of diseases like cancer in small animals. What we're going to be doing over the next year on the bacteria side of things is really starting with cells and then moving up through bacteria and then animal studies.
And why is it that DARPA has to jump in here? What's wrong with our own medical system?
Well, DARPA, I don't know if it's a matter of what's wrong. It's a matter of creating challenges. And so there are business challenges. And one of the problems, of course, in the antibiotic area is that from a drug standpoint, they're not nearly as big a market as, for example, an oncology type of drug. There are also just challenges in grand challenges in terms of chemistry and material science that have to be overcome. And you have to get a lot of different folks together to solve big problems. And DARPA is extremely good at doing that. They move very rapidly. When they recognize you have a big problem, they're able to, first of all, put together substantial resources, which is needed in this case, to challenge the academic community in this case to come up with alternative solutions and to think outside of the box. They're one of the best agencies for doing that.
So what you're saying is that the people are willing to spend money on the military to do this where they might not in the civilian case.
Well, yeah, the military has a different set of drivers, right?
Yeah.
So they're not...
So we used to think of the military as making weapons and transistors and things. They're now making drugs.
They make a lot of things. They made our GPS as well. They make a lot of things that positively affect civilians in day-to-day life, and this would be a big one.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Merkin, for taking time to be with us. Well, we'll have you back on when you get some results.
Thank you.
Your trials begin. Chad Merkin is director of the International Institute for Nanotechnology at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois.
Tomorrow marks the 10th anniversary of a technology that hit the market with high expectations, in hindsight, impossibly high.
What Henry Ford did in the last century for rural America is what this device will do in the next century for city dwellers.
That's inventor Dean Kamen, whose secret invention had two code names, Ginger and It. People in the know used words like revolutionary. Steve Jobs predicted it would be bigger than the PC. But the public had no idea what it was until December 3rd, 2001, when Kamen unveiled it on Good Morning America.
We're talking about the Segway. The self-balancing scooter weighed roughly 100 pounds, could go just over 12 miles an hour, with a price tag starting at $5,000. Now, while many tech experts were wowed, not everyone was impressed with Dean Kamen's invention or his hyperbole.
I believe the Segway HT will do for walking what the calculator did for pad and pencil.
Adding, or what the beer hat did for both beer and hats.
That's Jon Stewart on The Daily Show shortly after the Segway's unveiling. Well, 10 years later, walking has certainly not gone the way of the pad and pencil. And since its splashy debut, the Segway has made few headlines, except when President George W. Bush toppled off one.
But the device hasn't been a failure either. About 100,000 have rolled off the assembly line in the last decade, and the company turned a modest profit early last year. More than enough to require a calculator.
Is Siri anti-abortion? She is the voice-activated tool that comes on Apple's newest iPhone. And earlier this week, abortion rights groups raised a fuss when Siri sent people seeking abortions to anti-abortion sites. NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
Let's get one thing straight. On its face, Siri can seem, well, a little sexist. Siri, where can I get birth control?
I don't see any birth control clinics. Sorry about that.
Obviously, there are plenty of places to get birth control here in Washington, D.C. Then I asked her for Viagra.
I found 16 drugstores. 12 of them are fairly close to you.
But what outraged abortion rights advocates was that in many large cities, particularly New York and Washington, when you asked Siri where you could get an abortion, she would respond with something like this.
I found two abortion clinics a little ways from you.
By little ways, Siri actually means 27 and 74 miles, respectively. And neither of those are actually abortion clinics. Both are crisis pregnancy centers. They're places that not only don't do abortions, but actively try to talk women out of having them. Both cities, by the way, have multiple abortion clinics. Jody Jacobson is editor of RH Reality Check, a prominent abortion rights website.
Initially, people thought that the programmers had deliberately left something out. There was conjecture by many colleagues that perhaps because they were afraid of the anti-choice community.
But it turns out the actual reason is far more mundane.
It is, at the end of the day, just a dumb tool.
Damon Potter is a reporter with PC Magazine. He says there's two things going on. One is that Siri doesn't use Google, by far the most sophisticated of the search engines.
Google has had a decade to refine its results and get smarter and smarter about what people actually want when they do searches. Siri is in its infancy.
The other is that crisis pregnancy centers do search engine optimization. They use the word abortion a lot because they want to attract women in search of abortion. That's not the case with actual abortion clinics, says Jody Jacobson.
And the ways in which we might be self-censoring then lead us to have search engines that don't fully inform us about what we need.
Apple says it's working to fix the problem. Julie Rovner, NPR News.